This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. Nearly 9 hours of talks between Ukraine and Russia on Thursday failed to produce a breakthrough on signing a joint document. But both sides agreed to keep talking, this according to the chief of staff of Ukraine's president, after the talks in Berlin. Ukrainian and Russian officials met in the German capital for talks on ending the conflict in eastern Ukraine, with tensions running higher after Russia massed more than 100,000 troops near Ukraine's borders in recent weeks. The chief of staff to President Volodymyr Zelensky told a televised briefing that both sides would likely meet again soon and hope for a breakthrough on prisoner exchanges and the opening of checkpoints in eastern Ukraine. A White House official says the Biden administration has urged Canada to use its federal powers to resolve the truckers' blockade at the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario, where cross-border truckers have been protesting Canadian COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protest has carried on for nearly 2 weeks. The blockade prevented traffic from entering Canada on Wednesday, but U.S.-bound traffic continued. The mayor of Ottawa, the Canadian national capital, has declared a state of emergency in response to the demonstrations. Canadian police have warned that protesters, quote, must immediately cease further unlawful activity or face possible charges. The blockade has prompted the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to issue a warning that a convoy of truckers could begin protests as early as this weekend in Los Angeles, California, the site of the National Football League's Super Bowl game on Sunday. A White House official told Reuters the administration has no indication that those involved in the possible U.S. convoy are, quote, engaged in anything other than First Amendment protected activity. VOA News. The Biden administration has approved a nearly $14 billion arms sale to Indonesia as the U.S. presses ahead with steps it believes will help counter China's increasing assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific region. The State Department announced the $13.9 billion sale of advanced fighter jets on Thursday while Secretary of State Antony Blinken was visiting Australia. That visit is also intended to underscore the U.S. determination not to allow China free rein in the Pacific, even as developments between Russia and Ukraine demand attention. The sale to Indonesia of up to 36 F-15 fighter jets and related equipment, including munitions and communication systems, follows a trip by the Secretary of State to Jakarta in mid-December. At least 6 people were killed and 13 others injured in Somalia when a suicide bomber targeted a minibus full of delegates involved in the country's parliamentary elections on Thursday. The bomber detonated an explosives vest near a checkpoint leading to the presidential palace in Mogadishu, this according to security officials and the city's ambulance service. The Al-Shabaab militant group quickly claimed responsibility for the attack. It was not immediately clear if members of the delegates were among the casualties. The attack comes as Somalia's parliamentary elections continue in different parts of the country. Political leaders are trying to meet a self-imposed deadline of February 25th to finish the delayed elections. The U.S. Congress has given final approval to legislation guaranteeing that people who experience sexual harassment at work can seek recourse in the courts. It's a milestone for the Me Too movement, which prompted a nationwide reckoning on the way sexual misconduct claims are handled in the United States. The measure is expected to be signed by President Joe Biden. It bars employment contracts from forcing people to settle sexual assault or harassment cases through arbitration rather in court. And importantly, the bill is retroactive. It nullifies that language in contracts nationwide and opens the door for people who had been bound by it to take legal action. A former U.S. National Guard member and veteran of the war in Iraq has received a 6-month prison sentence for punching 2 police officers during the January 6th, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol. Mark Leffingwell of Seattle pleaded guilty to a felony assault charge in U.S. District Court on Thursday. Prosecutors had asked for a sentence of 27 months, but the judge chose a lighter sentence because she said the suspect had exhibited remorse and did not have a prior criminal history. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Today's Friday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chin Edwafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. forces relocating from Germany cross into Romania to shield NATO's eastern flank from potential Ukraine spillover.
Starting today, and obviously depending on whatever decisions NATO takes in terms of bolstering the effort here, we'll be part of that in any way that's appropriate.
The European Commission announces the investment of 50 billion euros in Africa to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative.
Speaking in Senegal, Ursula von der Leyen said the investments will be made under the Global Gateway Strategy, a scheme launched as an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative.
And a new study says 1 in 10 Australian health workers have thoughts of suicide during the COVID pandemic. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the Ukraine crisis has grown into, quote, the most dangerous moment, unquote, for Europe in decades. This as Russian forces hold sweeping maneuvers north of Ukraine in Belarus, part of a buildup of over 100,000 troops that has stoked Western fears of an invasion of Ukraine. His comments also come as U.S. forces relocating from Germany cross into Romania to shield NATO's eastern flank from potential Ukraine spillover. President Joe Biden is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania to bolster Eastern European defenses. In Romania, it is relocating a Stryker squadron of U.S. service members from Vilsack, Germany. The Stryker squadron, designed to deploy on short order, will add to the 900 soldiers the U.S. currently has rotating in Romania, some as part of NATO's force and some under separate bilateral arrangements. U.S. State Department Counselor Derek Chollet.
The bottom line is we will stand by our NATO and we've been doing so here in Romania for quite some time. We're adding to that starting today, and obviously depending on whatever decisions NATO takes in terms of bolstering the effort here, we'll be part of that in any way that's appropriate. All of us are thinking new about our security posture in Romania and the southern part of the eastern flank, and I think we have to understand that this crisis, even if we have a satisfying resolution of it, will probably create an enduring security challenge for the future. Now, if the worst happens and Russia follows through on what we're preparing to do, that, of course, will create an enduring security challenge, one that I think all of us have to think anew about this. So the discussions at NATO are going to be very, very important, and they're just beginning, but I think our contribution, it's the bilateral one right now. We'll look to augment anything that NATO does, and I think the U.S. generally would be supportive of any NATO efforts to build up the battle group here, because I think clearly Romania is facing acute threats from the situation unfolding not too far from here with the Russian escalation. Look, I think bolstering the eastern flank from north to south atop the NATO agenda, no question about it. And one thing we have made very clear to the Russian side is that if they continue this course of escalation, and if they choose to take the military path regarding Ukraine, they're going to see more NATO capability on the eastern flank.
That's U.S. State Department Counselor Derek Chollet. A senior Ukrainian official says her country would not bow to threats of military action from Russia and is prepared to fight to retain its sovereignty and territory integrity. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva says she does not believe Russia intends to invade her country. Rather, Yevhenia Filipenko says Russia's main objective is to destabilize Ukraine politically, economically, and militarily through the threatened use of force. Filipenko says Russia's massive troop and weapons buildup along Ukraine's border is aimed at achieving that result. She adds the large joint Russia-Belarus military exercise and the naval drills taking place in the Black Sea are part of the same plan. The Ukrainian ambassador says her government's goal is to discourage Russia from pursuing its aggressive course against Ukraine, Europe, and the European security order. That, she says, will be done through diplomatic means. She adds, however, that her country will not cross certain red lines in negotiating a diplomatic solution to the prevailing threat.
No concessions on sovereignty, territorial integrity within internationally recognized borders. Second, no direct dialogue with Russian occupation administrations in Donetsk and Luhansk. And third, only the people of Ukraine have the right to define foreign policy course.
Russian-backed rebels of the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics have been waging war against the Ukrainian government since 2014. The United Nations estimates more than 13,000 people have been killed in that war of separation, which continues. Donetsk and Luhansk are located in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Russian President Vladimir Putin denies planning to invade Ukraine. He has demanded that the West reject the possibility of Ukraine joining the NATO alliance and that the Western allies pull back their troops and armaments closest to Russia. Filipenko says the days when countries tried to impose their decisions on Ukraine are over. She says Ukraine will not bow to threats that will weaken the state and undermine its economic and financial stability. She says Ukraine is stronger, more resilient, and better prepared now to defend itself than it was in 2014. That was when Russia invaded Crimea and annexed the peninsula.
We have a very strong Ukrainian army, which is very determined to defend Ukraine and not to allow any further military occupation should the Russians make decision to further invade Ukraine.
Filipenko says Moscow will pay a very high price if it goes through with its threat. She says Ukraine's international partners have designed a comprehensive package of deterrence measures that will have serious economic and political consequences for Russia should it resort to military adventurism. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The conflict between Ukraine and Russia has been going on for a long time and has many fronts, not just military. The religious schism between Moscow and Kyiv patriarchates of the Orthodox Church and the struggle over the use of the Russian or Ukrainian language are two important battlegrounds in this conflict. John Speer narrates this report by Ricardo Marquina in Kyiv.
The bells call the faithful to Mass at the Cathedral of St. Vladimir in Kyiv. In a country under military threat from Russia, all spheres of life are marked by the conflict with Moscow, including spiritual life. This is the central cathedral of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, under the authority of Patriarch Filaret. The church in 2018 separated from the Moscow Patriarchate as a result of the tension generated by the earlier Russian annexation of Crimea and the war in eastern Ukraine. As leaders of the Kyiv Patriarchate see it, the Moscow-controlled church is a fifth column, or subversive element, of the Kremlin. Alexander Shmirin is a Ukrainian Orthodox priest under the Kyiv Patriarchate. Unfortunately, there are often elements of politics in the church. If we are saying that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Kyiv Patriarchy is the church of Ukrainian people, it's always with the words and deeds that stand in support of Ukrainian people and Ukrainian independence. At the same time, in the Ukrainian Church of Russian Patriarchy, there are elements and prayers for the Russian world and Russian interests. But the Ukrainian Orthodox Church under the Moscow Patriarchate is predominant in the country, which is home to great historic centers of the Orthodox faith, such as the Kyiv Monastery of the Caves. Representatives of the Moscow Patriarchate say the division within the Orthodox Church is artificial, and they deny that they are promoting the interests of the Kremlin in Ukraine. Nikolai Danielovich, a cleric under the Moscow Patriarchate, serves as a deputy director of the church's Office of External Relations.
All this informational noise is harming our country. If we are authentic patriots, true, not feigned, we should help calm down the situation. We here support our government and our president, who calls for calm.
The language has also become a part of a battle cry between Moscow and Kyiv, but also among the Ukrainians themselves. Ukrainian politicians appear to be united in making Ukrainian the only official language of the state. Kira Rudok, a member of the Ukrainian parliament, heads the liberal Holos, or Voice, party.
The proposition of Holos party is that we have one national language, one official language is Ukrainian. And as for the rest, we know that everybody could speak the language that they want to. We understand that for decades, Russian language was instilled in Ukraine because we were part of the Soviet Union. And right now, we need to give our language, the Ukrainian language, as much support as we can.
For critics of the Ukrainian government's language policies, such as Ivan Stepurin, a publisher of books in Russian, the politicization of the language is counterproductive for the country. He and others reject new measures which they say make it increasingly difficult to publish in Russian. It's very difficult for a person who has read Russian all his life to suddenly switch to Ukrainian. But especially in Ukraine, there are wonderful writers who write in Russian and who believe that Russian is part of the Ukrainian culture, like the rest of the languages of our multinational homeland. The armed conflict is also a political, religious and cultural conflict, a break both physical and spiritual between Russia and Ukraine that, depending on the outcome, may be decisive. For Ricardo Marchini in Kiev, John Speer, VOA News.
French leaders and their counterparts in the European Union are considering how to move forward with their anti-extreme military operations in the Sahel, especially Mali. Tensions between Mali and the EU, especially France, have frayed in recent months as Mali's military government has delayed a return to civilian rule. It has been further complicated by Bamako's decision to hire the Russian mercenary company, the Wagner Group, to help fight militant extremists in the region. Next week, leaders from the EU and the African Union hold a summit in Brussels. The agenda is expected to include the EU's Takuba Task Force, a military support operation in Sahel, and the French military's Operation Barkhane. Catherine Field is an analyst and journalist in Paris who follows the issues in the Sahel. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson Thursday about the tense relationship and what's expected at next week's summit.
We are essentially waiting for an EU-African Union summit, which happens in Brussels next week, to find out what steps the French are going to take for the next phase of their drawdown out of Mali. Now, we're not sure yet how this will work out. What we do know is that the French foreign minister has said there will be a decision taken because the situation cannot stay as it is. That red line for France was, of course, the presence in Mali of the Wagner Group, the so-called Russian mercenaries that the junta in Mali is accused of bringing in to help them out, if you like, to secure the area, particularly in Bamako. So we're not really entirely sure how the decision is going to be made with the French, whether they're going to regroup more and more around Gao, have their Barkhane forces there, or if they're going to say, no, this line has really been crossed by the Mali junta. Wagner are there. We're not hearing the right sounds when it comes to the presidential and parliamentary elections in Mali. We will then move off to Niamey and Rebase. A certain point is that the French want to give all this over to the European Union, have that Takuba force there as the face of the European Union rather than France.
Some of the EU members that have been participating in this effort in the Sahel, they have been expressing doubt about the situation. What's likely to come out of the EU? Is there any sense so far?
Not really. All we know is that they are trying to make this an international issue. What they're moving it away from, that it's not a Franco-Malian issue, it's an international community issue, that the international community has to deal with Sahel. So you're quite right that the Norwegians are dragging their feet, the Estonians are concerned, and the German parliament will have to make some sort of decision on extending the deployment of their Bundeswehr operation. We do get the feeling that we're coming to a moment when all of the EU is going to have to act with one voice, and they do seem to be coordinating very much with the ECOWAS and with the African Union, so it's not going to look as though it's just the Europeans.
Is there any consideration of other options? Instead of using military trainers, military operations to deal with the extremism issue, the violence in the Sahel, looking at other ways to bring in aid, provide employment, hospitals, schools, anything like that? Is there any consideration of taking a different tack?
This has been the subject for the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years. The European Union has been talking about the need to really go, if you like, go back to basics, to try and give some sort of support to local communities, to you get that support in there, not just, as you say, with healthcare and with schools, but to prop up local villages who are now, particularly in Mali, in a very difficult position, because you do have the jihadists who are targeting resource areas, they're charging people tax revenues, and they're occupying huge swathes of the country. So you're seeing local officials really finding that they have to do deals with these jihadists because there's no one else around. So they are also looking at that. But they are very cognizant that, particularly when it comes to Mali, this is a multi-layered issue. This is something that touches not just on security. You're looking at the political implications. You're also looking at the socio-economic implications of what's been going on there.
That's Catherine Field, an analyst and journalist in Paris, speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has announced 150 billion euros will be invested in Africa. It's part of a scheme aimed at boosting global recovery as an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Edward Buran of Reuters has more.
The 150 milliards d'euros.
Speaking in Senegal, Ursula von der Leyen said the investments will be made under the Global Gateway Strategy, a scheme launched as an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative.
Global Gateway is about investing in infrastructure, in strategic infrastructure, in industry infrastructure, but also in health, youth, education.
Africa's allocation accounts for more than half of the 300 billion euro fund, which was launched in December. Global Gateway aims to strengthen Europe's supply chains and fight climate change in sectors including health, energy and transport. It also comes as many European states are seeking to reduce illegal migration from Africa, which is driven in part by poverty and joblessness. Von der Leyen made the announcement alongside Senegal's president, Macky Sall. He's the current chairman of the African Union, which will hold a summit with the European Union next week.
Inflation soared over the past year at its highest rate in four decades, hammering American consumers, wiping out pay raises, and reinforcing the Federal Reserve's decision to begin raising borrowing rates across the economy. The Labor Department said Thursday that consumer prices jumped 7.5% last month, compared with 12 months earlier, the steepest year-to-year increase since February 1982. Shortages of supplies and workers, heavy doses of federal aid, ultra-low interest rates and robust consumer spending combined to send inflation accelerating in the past year. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. A new study says 1 in 10 Australian healthcare workers have thoughts of suicide or self-harm during the COVID pandemic. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The authors of the Australian Frontline Health Workers Survey believe it's the world's largest study of suicidal thoughts among healthcare workers. It canvassed the opinions of 8,000 staff in a range of positions and professions, including support staff, cleaners, doctors and nurses. The survey finds 10% of respondents have had thoughts of self-harm or suicide during the pandemic, but fewer than half had sought help from a mental health professional. Even before the emergence of COVID-19, Australian health workers had higher rates of suicide than those in other occupations. The study's authors said that emotional exhaustion and burnout were common among many respondents. What is unclear is the impact stress, which could cause more medical errors, has had on the quality of patient care. Georgina Lonergan, a nuclear medicine technologist in Victoria State, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, that her job was extremely stressful.
There's an undercurrent of anxiety, I think, for everyone working in healthcare. I've definitely had an undercurrent of anxiety increasing over the last couple of years. Some days you just really don't want to come. There's been a couple of days where I've been close to tears on the way in just from anxiety and just being tired of it all.
The survey was published Wednesday in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry. Much of Australia continues to battle a wave of Omicron variant infections. Government data has shown that more than 3,500 people are in the hospital with the virus. Since the pandemic began, Australia has detected 2.4 million coronavirus cases. 4,366 people have died, according to the health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including just after meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, French President Emmanuel Macron traveled to Kiev for talks with Ukraine's president as leaders and diplomats work to de-escalate tensions along the Ukraine-Russia border. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinyadwafo in Washington, wishing you a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States calls for the immediate release of all persons who have been unjustly detained in Chechnya. On January 27th, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a written statement, "The United States is troubled by continuing reports of abductions and arbitrary detentions carried out by authorities in Russia's Republic of Chechnya, including dozens of reported abductions and arbitrary detentions in recent weeks. Many of those targeted are the relatives of Chechen human rights defenders and dissidents. The arbitrary detentions have not been limited to cases in Chechnya," spokesperson Price noted. "There have been numerous instances of individuals being detained in other parts of the Russian Federation and forcibly transferred to Chechnya. A recent example is the case of Zarima Musayeva, the mother of human rights lawyer Akubakar Yangulbayev. On January 20th, she was taken from her home in Nizhny Novgorod in central Russia, taken to Chechnya, and placed in police custody. Amnesty International called her detention a kidnapping. In addition, Chechen authorities have publicly threatened the Yangulbayev family in recent days. In a February 1st video, the brutal leader of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, personally threatened the family and urged other countries to return members of the family living abroad to Russia. In a shocking statement the same day, Adam Delimkanov, a State Duma deputy from Chechnya, vowed to behead the family members. State Department spokesperson Price said such pressure tactics against the relatives in Chechnya of dissidents living outside of Russia harm entire families and are an especially pernicious form of repression. Kadyrov has been carrying out a campaign of violence in Chechnya for years, targeting dissenters, LGBTQI plus persons, members of religious and other ethnic groups, and others. The most recent human rights report on Russia by the U.S. State Department notes the reported abuses that have taken place in Chechnya by the authorities, including extrajudicial killings and mass torture of LGBTI persons, extrajudicial killings in other countries of those who oppose Republic of Chechnya authorities, and abductions and torture in the North Caucasus, including of political activists and others critical of Chechnya head Kadyrov. The United States," said spokesperson Price, "calls on Russian federal authorities to refrain from enabling repressive acts, including acts of transnational repression originating in Chechnya, and to bring those responsible for continuing egregious human rights violations in Chechnya to justice, consistent with the law of the Russian Federation and Russia's international human rights obligations."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the Voice of America. America, Washington, bam, bam, bam,